This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Well, it's been quite a week from Monday's report that President Trump revealed classified information to Russian officials at the White House to the appointment of a special counsel to investigate Russian interference in last year's election and lots in between. Yes, all of that happened just this week. And joining us to make sense of it all in this hour of the Friday News Roundup are Julia Yaffe, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Julia, welcome to 1A.
Hi.
Byron York is chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Naftali Ben-David is back with us. He's an editor and reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Naftali.
Thanks for having me.
We also welcome your questions about the week's top national news. There's plenty to discuss and plenty to try to make sense of. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. Well, if your smartphone subscribes to breaking news alerts, it was probably beeping and ringing all week long. Most of the headlines had to do with the ongoing, ever-changing investigation into possible collusion between the Trump administration and the Russian government. But there is still a lot we don't know. We don't know who the new head of the FBI will be. There's some reporting, but nothing confirmed by the White House yet. We also don't know whether or not Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, will cooperate with a congressional subpoena. His attorney says he won't. So let's start with what we do know. Let's talk about former FBI Director Robert Mueller and his new position as special counsel with the Russia investigation. The reaction to this seems to have been pretty well positive from a lot of quarters. Naftali Ben-David, is that still the way it stands right now?
I think so. I mean, Democrats have been calling for this for a long time. But for Republicans, I think for many of them, at least, there's a bit of a sense of relief. I mean, they didn't like every day emerging from their offices and hearing from constituents and from reporters, what do you think? Should there be a special counsel? What do you think about the latest thing that Trump said? Now they can say, well, look, there's a special counsel looking into this. Let's wait until he finishes his investigation. Then we can deal with it. But, the striking thing about these probes is that they're, in a sense, untrammeled. Bob Mueller's not going to have competing priorities. He's not going to have a ton of supervision. He's not going to have limitations on resources. For better or worse, the thing that marks these things is that they can be very wide-ranging and they can operate without a lot of restraints. So we're really entering a new phase of this.
Julia Yaffe, talk about what we know about Robert Mueller from when he was a director at the FBI, also a federal prosecutor, long history of service to the federal government, that might inform how he might manage this investigation.
Well, given that he started at the FBI a week before the 9/11 attacks, it seems like he is familiar with being parachuted into crisis situations and hitting the ground running. He seems to have a reputation of being quite independent, having a lot of integrity, and being this kind of prosecutor who after a long time in the FBI and at high government posts, missed the bank robberies and doing the everyday kind of crime stuff. So maybe he will enjoy this as a bit of kind of gumshoe sleuthing.
I think one of the concerns that's come out about the appointment of Robert Mueller to be special counsel is that it might affect the other kinds of investigatory work that has to go on. This is South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who spoke to reporters yesterday about Mr. Mueller's involvement in this investigation.
As general consensus, it was a good decision to pick a special counsel. A lot of confidence in Mr. Mueller. I think the shock to the body is it's now considered a criminal investigation. And Congress's ability to conduct investigations of all things Russia has been severely limited, probably in an appropriate fashion. So I think a lot of members want the special counsel to be appointed, but don't understand that you're pretty well knocked out of the game.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking yesterday about Robert Mueller becoming special counsel. Byron York, could you put that into some context for us? I thought that Robert Mueller's presence is inherently criminal, like he's looking to see if a crime was committed. If so, suggest charges. So that doesn't surprise me so much. But this idea of Congress's ability to conducting investigations being limited, can you clarify that a little bit?
Well, essentially, the investigation of the FBI trumps the congressional investigation. If you are a possible witness and you're worried about process crimes, perjury, lying to investigators, things like that, you don't want to double up on the number of opportunities you give yourself to do that. Why talk to this congressional committee? You're going to have to talk to the FBI at some point. And for a lot of reasons, this is a bad idea to do this. It was inevitable in the course of Washington scandals. It happens, but it's not a good idea. And perhaps one of the biggest is this is an investigation ill-suited to find out what we need to find out. A lot of people have begun to discuss the possibility that in terms of Russian collusion, which is the key question here, Russia-Trump collusion, there isn't really a crime at the bottom of this. And the FBI, the former FBI director, Mueller, is going to be looking for evidence of a crime. And the way it works is if you don't find it, you don't do like Comey did and with Hillary Clinton. You don't come out and say anything. You just don't charge anybody. So what we really need, I think, politically here is a public statement of what happened, which is where the Senate Intelligence Committee had been headed before this.
And I got the impression, Byron, from some of the other conversations we had about this earlier in this week on this program, that a number of members of Congress would be looking to whatever this special counsel found to help inform their investigation. Like you said, they're not going to tread the same ground twice, interview the same people twice. So Robert Mueller really has a lot of power in this whole environment of investigation.
Yeah, but a lot of this will remain very, very secret. If it's a grand jury investigation, there's all the stuff going on with the protections for grand juries. Members of Congress can't just call up and get that stuff. So I think Lindsey Graham is right that the investigation, the heart of it, has been taken out of Congress now and given to Mueller.
Is there any energy towards having a larger, like a select committee or another panel that would investigate this matter as well? Or is this kind of where it stops, particularly if we want to make sure that the findings are more public?
I mean, my guess is that it's for now where it stops. Certainly several Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, came out after this and said this is a good first step, but it shouldn't be the last step. And they argued for some of the same reasons that Byron's mentioning, that there should be a commission that's more public, that's more fact-finding based, that's not based on criminal investigations. I mean, the fact is the FBI does conduct counterintelligence investigations, too. It doesn't only conduct criminal investigations. And in my own view is that to some degree, Senator Graham was overstating the case. I think there's a lot of people in Congress who would love to say, well, Bob Mueller is handling this. Really, there's nothing else for us to do. And to be sure, there will be some collision and some conflict. But there will be many other people in Congress who are going to say, no, we need to forge ahead. Our role is different from Mueller's. And we need to proceed parallel to him and not just give up and throw up our hands because he's doing it.
Julia?
I think both Naftali and Byron are right. There's also the issue of just of resources. Adam Schiff, who heads the House investigation, he's the ranking Democrat, has complained that the FBI wasn't cooperating before this. So there's just going to be a lot of people asking for the same resources and them being strained. That said, there are, you know, two different questions, and only one of them is being addressed by the special prosecutor. That's the criminal one. Then there's the kind of the more political questions that are raised by all of this about, you know, is it, maybe it's not criminal to talk to the Russians during the campaign, or maybe it's not criminal to do some of the things that were done allegedly, but is it good? Is it wise for our country? So there's a whole other set of questions that need to be addressed that I don't know that Mueller's investigation addresses.
And before we go too deep into this, because I know there are very strong feelings on all sides, I want to make sure we're clear on the point that you're trying to make. It sounds like what you're trying to say is that Robert Mueller's job is looking through statutes, whether there's anything statutory that you could charge somebody with, as opposed to larger offenses of like, is this good for the nation? Is this impeachable from more of a moral democracy big picture
sense? Even impeachable necessarily, but just, you know, do we need to reform certain things? Do we need to change how things are done? You know, like the larger political questions as opposed to criminal questions.
That's Julia Yaffe of The Atlantic, also Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, and Byron York of The Washington Examiner with us for the national edition of the Friday News Roundup. We welcome your questions and thoughts. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A. You can also comment and watch the video stream of this hour on our Facebook page. You can also watch online online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter A, dot org. Bill in Fairfax, Virginia writes, can the president fire this special counsel just like FBI Director Comey? It seems to me that the special counsel should have been appointed by the legislative or judicial branches, but is that even possible, Byron?
Yes, he can fire him. This is something that arose in the 80s and 90s with the old independent counsel law, which was actually a statute passed by Congress that created a system where a judge would appoint a special, an independent counsel to investigate some sort of scandal or not. And there was this question, well, who could fire this independent counsel, some of whom seemed to want to stay in on the job forever? And the answer was the president has to be able to fire them, or you just created a fourth branch of government. The creation of an independent 9/11 style commission is probably one way to get around that if you want to. But I think Natalie's right. With this FBI thing going now, there's not going to be any appetite to create yet another investigatory body.
Yeah, we did talk to Congresswoman Jackie Speier about this more recently, and she said if the vote had to be held today, the votes are not there. We also spoke to Congressman Adam Schiff, I should note, this week on the program. You'll find that also on our website, the1a.org. We're up against a break in just a moment, but I would like to get to Matt's comment. Matt in Vermont writes, regarding the Trump controversy, it's all red meat for Democrats, but some of us think this hyperventilation is damaging to the country. Our system is solid. Let it work. Well, Matt, you're getting into some of the larger political questions about what all of this means for our ability to just run the country. And we'll get into those questions as we continue with the roundup with Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Julia Yaffe of The Atlantic, and Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. We welcome your questions and thoughts. Email 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Julia Yaffe of The Atlantic, Byron York of The Washington Examiner, and Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. Matt in Vermont wrote, regarding the Trump controversy, it's all red meat for Democrats, but some of us think this hyperventilation is damaging to the country. Our system is solid. Let it work. Well, Matt, that probably echoes some of what President Trump said earlier this week about the Russia investigation. He mentioned it at a news conference yesterday in response to a question, and he just drove home his message a little further that this whole Russia investigation, in his view, has no teeth.
Well, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero. I think it divides the country. I think we have a very divided country because of that and many other things.
That's President Trump speaking at a news conference yesterday alongside the president of Colombia. What about that, this idea that we're kind of hyperventilating and that it is divisive to the country and distracting to the other things we have to do? Julia?
Well, the Russians would certainly agree. On a recent trip to Moscow, Every Russian I spoke to, both on the anti-Kremlin side and pro-Kremlin side, think we've lost our minds and that we're making something out of nothing. That said, the president has not helped his own case. If he had not fired James Comey, if he had not the next day invited Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak into the Oval Office with only a Russian photographer there, and then leaked them, or not leaked them, gave them highly classified information, this would have just continued kind of simmering on the back burner instead of exploding into the forefront and involving everybody and getting a special prosecutor appointed. Like, he could have just let this kind of simmer in the background, and instead he's moved it to the forefront.
But there's no question that this idea that this is the press and the Washington establishment out to get a president they don't like, that's one of his big lines of defense, and it does resonate with a certain number of people. Throughout from the campaign, you know, these were people that he held up as against him, the people he was fighting. And so now that's going to be the storyline. It also has to be said that depending on which side you're on, you think an investigation is against the interests of the country and dividing the country. It's what the Democrats thought about Ben Gazi. Benghazi, and now it's what the Republicans say about Trump. Of course, when they're looking into you, you decry it as being divisive. But that said, I mean, I think this narrative that he's putting out there does ring true to a large number of people in the country.
That's it. The system is...
Well, and we should also be clear that there are some Republicans, you know, who have said that we are a nation of laws and not of men. Florida Senator Marco Rubio said so yesterday. And there is a line of conversation that says, we have to let this play out. And, we need to know.
And Byron? I think he had a point. From what I can tell, the Senate Intelligence Committee was making a good bit of progress. And we've had more and more statements that they have not seen evidence that proves that there was any collusion going on here. And the key question of this has always been, did Trump or his associates collude, coordinate with the Russians to try to influence the election? And if that is the core question, I think we're seeing more and more often people seeing that they don't have information about that. And the investigation seems to be going off in different directions. Like, whoa, what about Michael Flynn and Turkey? You know, did he violate the Foreign Agent Registration Act? Or what about some of Paul Manafort's sleazy business deals a decade ago? And I'm sure these are all going to be investigated, but the key question the president may have a point on.
Well, then maybe Caleb's question kind of gets to that in terms of how we deal with all this. Caleb writes, I read in the Washington Post that there are important differences between a special counsel and an independent counsel, one being that a special counsel is still technically in the Trump chain of command, who reports to the deputy attorney general, whereas an independent counsel would not. Could your panel help us understand the differences?
I mean, that's basically right. The independent counsel statute was enacted after Watergate, and we're all familiar with it from the Clinton era, because Ken Starr was an independent counsel, but there was like six or eight of them or something during that administration. And they are more independent. They're appointed by a three-judge panel and are designed to be essentially completely outside the Justice Department chain of command. In this case, Bob Mueller will report to Rod Rosenstein. And in fact, Rod Rosenstein can overrule some of his decisions, although it's difficult to do, and he has to report to Congress when he does it. But the idea here is to try to find a balance between having this done with some kind of restraint on him, but giving him the freedom he needs to pursue politically sensitive matters.
Julia?
I did just want to add one comment to the previous listener's comment. This is the system working. You know, this is the system responding to certain shocks, to certain questions. You could argue that all these investigations are the system working, the laws working, the independent institutions working.
Also against the backdrop of all of this is another former FBI director, James Comey. And this week we learned that Mr. Comey apparently wrote and sent memos about his meetings with President Trump. According to reporting from the New York Times, Mr. Comey wrote that Mr. Trump had urged him to drop the investigation into former National Security Advisor nominee Michael Flynn. He was fired shortly after for lying about conversations he had with the Russians. Where does this whole James Comey memo thing sit right now? Do we know if the memos are there? Has he agreed to hand them to anybody? Is this still just a report from the New York Times? Where does this sit right now?
Well, Congress wants these, and we've had interest in them from both the House and the Senate. It's not clear where the new appointment of Mueller fits in all this. It may mean that we can't see them, but certainly the Senate Judiciary Committee, the House Oversight Committee, wanted to see these memos and, to the degree possible, make them public. So then, of course, it brought up a lot of talk about obstruction of justice. I'm not a lawyer. A lot of lawyers have argued on both sides of the question. But I think a little bit of context might be useful here in this, on the substance of this conversation that he describes. At the time there had been the conversation, there had been a report in the Washington Post saying the FBI had cleared Flynn of wrongdoing, specifically in connection to his phone conversations with the Russian ambassador. And of course, Flynn had just quit. He'd been fired by Trump. So Trump says, hey, can you let this thing go?
Do we know whether or not James Comey is going to speak publicly? Sally Yates did an interview on CNN this week, so she has kind of broken her silence in a way. Do we expect James Comey to testify before Congress? Is he going to get his Anderson Cooper interview? I mean, when are we going to hear from him again?
Well, I mean, we don't know for sure, of course, but I'm going to guess yes. I mean, I think that Comey, in general, it's ironic in a way because arguably he got in trouble for speaking out too much during the Hillary Clinton investigation. And now people want him to talk more than he is. But his history sort of is that he does come out and talk and give his version of events. He's very good at it. And my guess is he's just picking his moment. In fact, these memos, there's a sense in which it feels a little bit like Jim Comey's revenge. It may or may not have played out that way. But, you know, Donald Trump could have fired him in a much more courteous, gracious way. But he didn't. He learned about it on TV. The president proceeded to criticize and I would say even insult him in public. And so shortly after that, associates of Mr. Comey let it be known that there are all these memos, including this one fairly explosive one. Now the question is, how many of these are there? What do they say? And when are we going to get to see them?
It's interesting, in the Sally Yates interview with Anderson Cooper, she said that she actually got her termination letter. She held it, and she knew what it was, but someone actually put it in her hand. She didn't get the termination letter when she was halfway across the country. Speaking of the FBI, do we know who the next director might be? There's been talk this week that it might be former Senator Joe Lieberman, and there are questions on both sides with that. Is this all just kind of rumor mill, or has anything solid come out so far?
Well, I mean, the White House said Lieberman is their leading contender, but there's been actually contradictory messages coming out of the White House, and it hasn't been the smoothest process. But the striking thing about it, I think, is how much they seem to be looking at politicians. Traditionally, that just has not been done. It's one of many things this administration has done that's not in any way forbidden. It's just not usually the way it's handled. And so they've talked about John Cornyn. They've talked about Mike Rogers. They've talked about of course, Joe Lieberman. And so we'll see if that kind of plays, because this is a Senate-confirmed position.
I think the Lieberman thing is probably a no-go. It's one of these things where Trump would say, well, he's a Democrat, so they'll like him and vote for him. I mean, he's the Democrats' least favorite Democrat, if you look at the way he left the Senate. So I believe what's going to happen is there was talk about trying to get this nomination out the door by the time the president left for his big foreign trip, and that's probably not going to happen. And then that gives you a period of a week and a half, 2 weeks, to keep the search up.
Chris in Durham, North Carolina asks, is the appointment of a special counsel a good thing for Democrats? It seems things were moving very rapidly prior to the appointment of Mueller. Now the timeline for investigations may be years rather than weeks or months, which allows for more than enough time for the GOP to work on its agenda.
Julia? I would argue with the notion that things were moving really rapidly. I think they were moving really rapidly in the news, and it seemed like they were moving really rapidly. But if anything, the Senate committee investigating this was moving very slowly. They were trying to, I mean, they were doing a lot of things right, but in order to do them right, in order to do them in a bipartisan way, when the country is so divided, things were moving quite slowly. So this doesn't necessarily slow it down. It kind of channels the flow into a different direction.
Catherine writes, if collusion between Russia and members of Trump's campaign team can be shown, wouldn't this demonstrate that the whole Trump administration is not legitimate? Impeachment would not be appropriate. The elimination of the whole administration is what's needed. Could this have some kind of a domino effect?
I mean, I don't...
How do you eliminate a whole administration?
Yeah, I don't think we have a mechanism for that, but I mean...
That would truly be a constitutional crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the writer is raising is if it seems to be shown that Russia helped get Trump elected, then it would raise into question his legitimacy. But I think that is, in a sense, a political question. I mean, we don't have a way in this country to sort of remove an administration. I mean, I guess in theory, the president, but maybe he would have won anyway. That's one of those things that would thrive in the political world, not so much in the actual world.
I mean, they're called elections. They're just not for quite a while. You know, he's only 4 months into this term. So, and given the speed with which things have been happening in the next 3.5 years, you know, who knows?
Although many Democrats have been talking about impeachment. As a matter of fact, some of their leaders are not happy with them talking about it quite as much. If you go back to 2006, when George W. Bush, when the Iraq War was just falling apart, there were a number of Democrats who wanted to impeach Bush, and they're running for election in November of 2006. Things look good for Democrats. Nancy Pelosi finally has to say, impeachment is off the table. We're not going to do it. And I think you could be finding a situation like that next year, where a lot of Democrats would want to impeach the president if they controlled the House of Representatives. But leaders would be loath, I think, to make 2018 a referendum on impeachment.
Julia?
Yeah, and I think Byron's absolutely right. I think also Democrats are now finding themselves in a place where they'd been dreaming of getting Trump out of the Oval Office ahead of time, and now they're thinking, wait, who would replace him? Oh my God, Vice President Mike Pence, who actually knows how the system works, knows how to work it, is more liked, is less polarizing, and would be able to push through a really conservative agenda that's anathema to Democrats, but in a much smoother, harder to fight way. And so it's kind of like with the dilemma that Democrats had with Comey, like, hate him, but don't too scared to remove him.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Evan tweeted us, Jason Chaffetz just won re-election in 2016, but now he wants time with his family? Something smells funny. Well, Evan is referring to a statement on the congressman's website from yesterday that Congressman Jason Chaffetz, a Republican from Utah, confirmed that he will resign from Congress next month. Currently, he serves as the chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Why is Jason Chaffetz resigning? And what does this mean in a larger political sense? Naftali?
Well, you know, of course, we don't know for sure, but an obvious point, I think, is that if you're chairman, a Republican chairman of an investigative committee, it's much better and much more comfortable if you're going against a president, Hillary Clinton. Everybody in the party will be very happy and very supportive if you investigate her. In fact, he called that a target-rich environment during the campaign. To investigate a President Trump of your own party, much, much less comfortable, especially for a guy who may have bigger ambitions. So while I don't know the reasons specifically, it's not as shocking as it may at first appear that even though he had kind of a powerful position, that it's not the most comfortable one and may want to remove himself from it.
Do we think he might have bigger ambitions?
I mean, that's certainly the word is that he might, yeah. I mean, whether they would be successful is another question, but I think he's a ambitious, relatively young, relatively attractive guy, so I think that's very much a possibility.
Byron?
Yeah, he got a little new life in him with these Comey memos. He jumped out in front of everybody else demanding the Comey memos. I don't know. I think a lot of people found this kind of mystifying. But it is true, basically, that the president's party, if the president's party controls the House and the Senate, they just don't do a lot of oversight. But it's a much more pressurized situation now, just given Trump.
Go ahead, Julia.
So, I'm sorry. And sure. He's still a very popular president with the party. He's something like 80% of Republicans support Trump. So if Jason Chaffetz were to apply the same kind of aggressive investigatory tactics that he did towards, let's say, Benghazi or the Clinton email investigation, how would that look to voters back home?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen next with this young, attractive congressman from Utah. But what about the committee itself? I mean, this week, Congressman Chaffetz requested all the FBI documents detailing the communication between James Comey, former director of the FBI, and President Trump. Does this affect the committee at all, or can they just kind of go on and do business without him?
They can go on and do business without him. There's one interesting thing about that request that I should have mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. The Senate Judiciary Committee made the same request. Charles Grassley, the chairman, Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat, signed it, and they wanted all the Comey memos having to do with Trump and the Clinton email investigation, which I thought was an interesting addition. And these requests have a lot more force when you have the Republican and the Democrat on the committee signing it. So it's going to be very interesting to see if these things come out. And if they do, I think it would be in response to that request.
We got to pause in just a moment, but let's get to at least one more comment. Henry wrote, I don't understand what the big deal is about Comey's memo. It's still he said, he said. What's the big deal about this memo, Julia?
Well, as I understand it, the memos like this where an FBI agent writes down in detail what just happened is admissible in court, as I understand, as evidence. Like, this is a document that is trusted by our judicial system as evidence. So it's not just he said, he said. It's like he said, but he said in a way that is admissible.
It's like
court.
A written form of testimony, basically.
Right. Mm, yeah.
But also remember, I think all we know is that Comey wrote all these memos, and then he's given them to some friends, and the friend read one passage of one of them to the New York Times. I mean, there is so much more to know about this.
Yeah, the New York Times article did say that they were basing it on accounts of having heard the memo read, but that they had not actually seen the memo for themselves. We are going to take a break in just a moment. When we come back, we'll continue the Friday News Roundup with Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Julia Yaffe of The Atlantic, and Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. And we want to play off of a comment from another one of our listeners when we come back. Deb wrote, speaking of witch hunts, most would consider Trump's commission on voter fraud a witch hunt. The president has had a lot to say about all these investigations lately, called it a witch hunt, has been very active on Twitter, also spoke to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy this week during its commencement and had something to say there. We'll get into that and the implications of it when we continue, and we welcome more of your questions. Email 1A at WAMU.org, comment and watch the video stream on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. We're going to catch our breath and come right back. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Julia Yaffe of The Atlantic, and Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. Deb wrote us, speaking of witch hunts, most would consider Trump's commission on voter fraud a witch hunt. That term came up yesterday when President Trump took to Twitter to declare himself the target of one day after the Justice Department announced that Robert Mueller would become special counsel, as we described earlier. The president tweeted, quote, with all of the illegal acts that took place in the Clinton campaign and Obama administration, there was never a special counsel appointed. This is the single greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history. Soon after that, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton responded, tweeting, as the representative of Salem, Massachusetts, I can confirm that this is false. What are we to make of the president calling this a witch hunt against him?
Well, it's a continuation of the way he's always talked. I mean, first of all, he often has presented himself as a victim. So the idea of this kind of language, of, he also said the other day that no politician has ever been treated as unfairly as he has. That's the kind of language that he uses a lot. And it's very dramatic. Nothing is ever just bad. It's always a total disaster.
He does know that four presidents have been shot in office, right?
Well, you know, there's a certain...
Shot dead in office.
Right. And it does seem often in his comments that there's a certain lack of historical perspective. And I think that's fair to say. You know, he made this comment sort of famously that how come nobody ever asks how the Civil War got started? And obviously there are books and books and books about that. And there's a there does seem to be a certain lack of knowledge or perspective. Obviously, the McCarthy era was a period of huge witch hunts, Palmer raids. It's not hard to think of really dramatic political witch hunts that happened in this country. But more important, I think, is his method of political rhetoric, which is very grandiose, very dramatic, often puts him in the role of victim. Sometimes it seems to me it's taken more from the world of the commercial world that he is used to operating in, where everything's the best and the biggest and the grandest. But it's his style. And I think it's clearly easy to sort of present historical contradictions to that, but it's the way that he talks, and it's worked for him in many ways.
But then again, to Naftali's point, maybe that just doesn't really matter in the calculus of the political rhetoric, that this is just the kind of rhetoric that we have become used to from Donald Trump as a candidate, and now Donald Trump as president. He's being kind of the same person he's always been.
I think in part he's commenting also just on press coverage of his campaign. A new study came out this week from the Shorenstein Center at Harvard about coverage of the first 100 days of Trump, and it was remarkably negative compared to the coverage of any other first 100 days, about 80% negative compared to, I think, about 40% negative for Barack Obama, and that there were some particular news outlets like CNN, who are way, way above the 80% mark, above the 90% mark. So I think some of it is just Trump's sense of grievance about press coverage, which does resonate with a lot of Republicans. So I don't think he hurts himself by saying this.
Julia?
Well, it's also, I mean, saying the coverage is, it's not like the same thing happens in the first 100 days of every administration and the press just decides to go negative or go positive, right? There are different things happening, and some of them are objectively more crazy, more chaotic, more politically fraught than others.
Or perhaps unprecedented for different reasons.
Unprecedented, right, sure. The other thing is, you know, these attacks, not only, as Naftali said, you know, are coming from his commercial TV background, but also it's, you know, it's a very good political tool at delegitimizing people who are opposed to him. That is just something, you just don't like me. It's not that you have actual grounds to disagree with me. We're not just having a disagreement. It's the absolute negation, invalidation of the other point of view.
We got a message from Seth, who is a tour guide with Salem Heritage Tours. And he wrote, being a tour guide here in Salem, I agree with Congressman Moulton and can attest to the fact that Trump's comment about the witch hunt is untrue. Thank you, Seth. Now we have it confirmed.
It's also, I mean, there's a reason he says the word witch hunt, and we all know he's not talking about the Salem witch trials. You know, like, right. like the reason he says that, and we know he means it's a political campaign, is because there have been other massive witch hunts in American political history.
Well, and it also came up this week during his commencement speech to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. He spoke there on Wednesday and had this to say.
Never, ever, ever give up. Things will work out just fine. Look at the way I've been treated lately. Especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
That was President Trump speaking at commencement at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, speaking on Wednesday. I wonder what the outcome of this might be. On the one hand, yes, I get he's kind of speaking past the media to his base. On the other hand, he is speaking to a group of American service members who are about to put their lives on the line for the country, who could die in the service of this country in myriad ways, and making it about him and the way the media has treated him. I'm not sure. How does that play?
Well, I didn't attend the speech. I watched the whole thing on video. I mean, if you don't want a speech to be about Trump, then don't have Trump come and speak. but you know, what was interesting is that very clip you played, which is basically the only thing that was reported about the speech. Most of the speech was about how great you are in the Coast Guard, what great service you render to this country. You put your lives at risk. It was a lot about the Coast Guard. But when he comes to the conclusion about don't let the naysayers get you down, there'll be people who are going to be negative. You've just got to ignore the criticism and keep going to live your dream. It got the biggest applause of the whole time. And I don't think they were applauding in saying, oh, yes, President Trump, you've had a rough time of it. They were applauding the sentiment that you shouldn't give up in life. So I just don't think this has any great effect beyond the coverage of that particular speech.
And actually, to your point, I've got the transcript of that speech from the White House's website. To your point, another part of the speech, he said, years from now, some of them may look back and ask themselves whether they've made the right choice, whether they've made the most of the opportunities they've been given. In the Coast Guard, you will face many challenges and many threats. But one thing you will never have to face is that question of what will I do? When you look back, you won't doubt. You'll know exactly how you spent your time saving lives. That's also from the transcript of what President Trump said at the Coast Guard Academy on Wednesday. Maybe part of the reason why we're getting different conflicting clips of what the president said is because the news environment has changed so much in the last few years. And one of the mandarins of cable news just passed away this week. Roger Ailes, the founder and longtime CEO of the Fox News Channel, died this week. He launched Fox News Channel in 1996, right around the time that MSNBC launched, but as part of Fox, led by media mogul Rupert Murdoch, quickly became a dominant force in cable news. What do we make of the legacy of Roger Ailes? There's so many different things to say about him. Julia?
You know, in medicine, there's this well-known phenomenon where, let's say, one member of an elderly couple dies and the other follows shortly thereafter. Like, they can't live without each other. And I feel like this is a weird analog of that, bear with me, where Roger Ailes spent decades kind of preparing the ground for somebody like Trump, helped get him elected, and with his mission accomplished, you know, went to the next world.
Maybe.
Sorry, maybe that's a little too poetic for Friday morning.
Well, but then there's also perhaps the fact that he ended Fox News under very ignominious circumstances with the whole sexual harassment matter and some of Fox's blue chip stars like Megyn Kelly and Gretchen Carlson coming out and saying, no, really, he allowed an environment to exist at Fox News that was untenable.
Well, I say this as a Fox News contributor. Clearly, I think he was the greatest, the best media executive, not just TV executive, but media executive of his generation, maybe a couple of generations before that. I mean, very, very impressive man. And I think one of the things that is lost when people view Fox entirely through the lens of politics, one of the things that is lost is that just how good he was at television. And I think people watched Fox more than they watched the competition because he was such an incredibly good TV producer. He produced shows that people wanted to watch. And my feeling is, my personal feeling is that when somebody dies, you try to look at the biggest thing they did or the best thing they did. And with him, clearly, that is the creation of this network that did not build itself, this creation of this extraordinarily powerful and consequential news organization.
Now, I will grant you that. I remember in the early days of Fox News, like right when they launched, I loved watching Fox because they were younger and hipper. They weren't boring and stodgy like CNN. Like, they and MSNBC shook up the environment. And for me, as a teenager watching cable news, I had something that felt a little more peppy and energetic and youthful. But it is also worth noting that's not his whole legacy. I mean, one of our listeners tweeted, Roger Ailes is a sexual predator. He shouldn't be lauded. He's leaving this world with a very mixed reputation, and one that I think a lot of people say just hurt the democracy by poisoning the way we talk to one another.
Yeah, I mean, right, there's the sexual harassment issue, but there's also the issue that he may have been a talented television guy, but what he really brought to the table that no one had before is this idea that, look, television newscasts may purport to be neutral and unbiased and nonpartisan, but there's a lot of people in the country that don't believe that. And so there's a different set of facts, and there's a different set of people to give you those facts, and we're going to play to those people. And he's in part responsible for this environment, although in some ways I think he reflected it as much as he shaped it, in which people don't just disagree with what should be done. They don't agree on basic facts. They don't agree on who can be trusted, media figures, scientists, book publishers, academics. He's really been a big part of this world that we now live in which it's very difficult for us to talk to each other.
Do we think that Donald Trump would have become president if Fox News did not exist?
Yes, I think so.
You do?
Well, I mean, look at all the people who were angry at CNN for showing an empty podium waiting for a Trump speech rather than covering other parts of the campaign. Trump electrified the entire media atmosphere. And I will say one thing about the product of Fox News. Again, I'm a Fox News contributor. Going back to this Shorenstein Center study I mentioned a few minutes ago, CNN coverage 93% negative during the first 100 days. Fox coverage 52% negative, majority negative, but way, way different. And I think viewers felt that they were getting a more complete story.
Do you think that Trump would be president?
I answered your question first by saying that it would not be possible. I think there's, Fox really did, you know, it didn't happen in 1 year. It didn't even happen in 5 years or 10 years. It happened over a long period of time. I mean, and I agree that there's a reason people watch it. It's, you know, it's entertaining, it's engaging, it's flashy, but it did completely change the narrative. And changed the way journalism is perceived, that we all have an opinion, so why even bother hiding it?
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Drite writes on Twitter, I'm uncomfortable that you and your panel discuss the Trump presidency as if it's normal. Vice President Mike Pence may be as culpable as Trump regarding Russia. We keep getting these comments about normalizing the Trump presidency, and I get the point about bearing in mind that these are very unusual times, these are very unusual circumstances. Does Drite have a point? Are we normalizing all of this?
I mean, we're talking about it. He is the president, and he's doing things, and we're discussing them, and we're trying to be kind of objective and neutral about it. I don't know what the alternative is. It's just constantly saying, this has not been done before. I feel like that was done a lot in, you know, the mainstream press throughout the transition. And bearing in mind the kind of the popular movement that Trump came out of, it kind of read a little bit like when you say like, oh, this person has not been properly vetted, or this person has not, like, this has been done in a way that's not precedented. It read a little bit like he's using the fish fork for the steak. You know,
I do think a lot of the heat has gone out of that as kind of time has gone on. You know, a special counsel's now been appointed and the process has begun to play out. Maybe that's kind of helped to take some of the heat out of the discussion, because now it just becomes a procedural story.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the point, too, and I understand the frustration on the part of the Democratic base, you know, at least that we talk about this the way we talk about any other president. But I'm also not sure what the alternative is. Things are happening that aren't normal. For example, the appointment of a special counsel. And in some sense, if things are happening that aren't normal, that's up to the system to handle. I'm not sure, you know, the media, we report this stuff, but ultimately it's not us who take actions in response to abnormal behavior. So I'm not sure exactly what it is that we should be doing.
Also, and the fact that we report it, I'm sorry to The fact that we report it and we say, like, this isn't usually done, I mean, that does say this is not normal. This does not usually happen. We're reporting about it because it's happening.
Byron? And some of it is normal. I mean, there was a special counsel investigation in the Bush years. I think everyone remembers the CIA Valerie Plame leak affair. Obviously, Bill Clinton just had independent counsels, you know, out the door. And a lot of the other stuff is actually normal news. There was a debacle over trying to repeal Obamacare on Capitol Hill. The president was involved, Republican leadership was involved. That was just a real political story. Same thing as gearing up, maybe not a debacle, but on tax reform in the Senate and in healthcare in the Senate. I mean, there are a lot of just actual normal news stories having to do with this administration.
Well, I want to bookend the program the way that we began the program, not with the circus in Washington, but with the circus that we all know and love. This Sunday evening, the curtain will close on the greatest show on earth. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, which started in Baraboo, Wisconsin, will perform its final show in Long Island, New York, marking the end of 146 years of the traveling circus. The final show will also stream live on Facebook at 7 p.m. Eastern Sunday. Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey fell out of favor as more people questioned its treatment of animals and questioned whether animals should be kept in captivity to do tricks at all. Tastes also began to change to other kinds of circuses, most notably the animal-free Cirque du Soleil. I'm going to miss Ringling Brothers, kind of. I mean, it's one of those things that you do as a kid that you always remember. Nothing against Cirque du Soleil, but it's the end of an era.
It was a 19th century institution that made it all the way to the 21st century. The only thing I didn't know reading about this was there's a group called the Circus Fans Association of America, who I assume have placed a black wreath over their door today.
No doubt about it.
I'm wondering what happens now to kids who hate their parents. They can't run away and join the circus anymore. Like, what are they going
to
do?
You could join Cirque du Soleil. You okay, can go to Vegas. Sure. You can go to Disney. You can go around the world. They've got a new show on Broadway. There will always be a circus to run away.
They can. Okay, good.
They could come to Washington.
Oh, God. Yeah, join this circus. become a page.
Exactly. And work your way up. Julia Yaffe, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Julia, thanks for being part of this circus today.
Thank you.
Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thank you, Byron.
Thank you.
And Naftali Ben-David, an editor and reporter with the Wall Street Journal.
Thanks so much.
Remember, we will continue our conversation online. We invite you to continue talking about the week's top news online. Email us 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.